Hey guys, Maria Menounos here. Before your favorite TV after show begins, we want to let you know about my new show on SiriusXM Stars Channel 109. It's called Conversations with Maria, and it's live Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. Go to conversationswithmaria.com for more info. Buzz you later.
You're tuning in to the online broadcast network, AfterBuzz TV. Over 20 million weekly downloads in over 150 countries and your number one source for after-show entertainment. AfterBuzz TV, the destination for TV superfans, producing aftershows for over 300 of your favorite TV shows, interviewing celebrities and showrunners, and bringing you behind-the-scenes exclusives. All thanks to E! Entertainment's Maria Menounos, producer Kevin Undergaro, and internet leader Akamai. Now, let the buzz begin!
Yes.
See, you all know this music. I don't know this music.
Hello, AfterBuzzers. Welcome to the People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story AfterBuzz TV After Show. I'm your host, Pegarad. You can follow me on Twitter at Pegarad. I'm joined by
Shaka Smith. You can follow me on Twitter or Instagram at Shaka Strong.
I'm Stephanie Georgie. You can find me on Instagram at the Stephanie Georgie and on Twitter at Stephanie Georgie.
The Stephanie Georgie. And I'm Chris Howard. You can follow me on Twitter at Chris Howard Live, and you can also find me at LegendaryLivingDaily.com, where I've got lots of inspirational, motivational type stuff. Cool stuff.
Awesome. And today we are joined by a very special guest. He is a true crime writer, wrote many books in his career, and also called Verdict, the Chronicle of the O.J. Simpson Trial, Michael Fleeman. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Tell us about your involvement with this whole case.
Well, it goes back literally to the day of the murders. And I was working at the Associated Press. We got a police bulletin that somebody had been killed on Bundy in Brentwood. And that set off a lot of alarms. It's a place where people don't get murdered. Mm-hmm. And we weren't sure. So we sent an intern, and I stayed back at the office and started writing the stories. And over the next couple of years, I covered just about every day of the O.J. Simpson case for the Associated Press. I was in the trial every single day. I covered the civil trial afterwards.
Wow. Amazing.
That's a lot of background. We're pretty lucky to have you here, so thank you for coming.
Thank you for joining.
Can't wait to pick your brains. This is going to be exciting. Before we get started, I just want to remind you guys to go on to iTunes, give us 5 stars, rate, comment. We want to hear from you guys. Subscribe to our channel. Let us know how we're doing. Check out all our other videos. We have tons of videos.
And let us know your thoughts. Let us know what do you like, what do you not, what do you feel, what are your opinions.
Exactly. And actually, and before we get started as well, I just want to give some shout-outs. We do appreciate everyone who has commented. Thank you to Ranchok29, Lynn Reed, Andrew Music, Shell A, JDTV, Dave155, LR Nell, and Andrea Chavez, Ready RM, Melvin Fan, B Day Chick, B Simpson, and Tara K, and Leslie T for some of the Twitter involvement that you had us.
Involved
us in. So
it's awesome. Keep reaching out.
We're giving you guys the shout outs. Just let us know.
Yeah, we love hearing from you guys. So keep it coming. Yeah. Today we are breaking down season 1, episode 2, The Run of His Life. Initial thoughts. What do you guys think?
Oh, boy. Wow. I mentioned to one of our friends here in the studio that it was as long an episode as it seemed while the thing was really happening in real time. I remember it was like, when is this thing going to end? And I say that with reverence for the episode because I think they did the episode really, really well. But it was, it was a whole ordeal. It was a saga in and of itself.
I didn't realize what a gentlemanly police chase it was. It was just a very civil, beautiful police chase.
Yeah. And we'll totally get into that and the whole LAPD in a little bit. But I want you to keep that thought for sure.
Right, because I had mixed feelings about that, especially in later quotes, which we'll bring up later. Chris said, I couldn't believe how long that was. It really did take that episode, and it was exhausting to watch. Not to mention exhausting for everyone who was involved just for that day and for nothing to happen but that simple arrest at the end of the night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We know where we were. Michael, where were you at the time?
I was at the Associated Press Bureau, and I was sitting at my computer terminal with a television in front of me writing the story off TV. We had photographers in the field. We had other reporters out there. but it was surreal. I had never written a story like that before or since. And it was just bizarre. And I was at a loss for words half the time. What do you write? And I think what was so amazing about the episode was that they brought us inside the Bronco, which none of us really had been. And Jeff Toobin's book sort of did. But the drama, it really brought it all back.
Yeah. Mm. I did not think of that. Obviously, what you wouldn't see when it actually happened, how it would be for anyone who lived through it.
Yeah.
To say, to either to believe 100% that that's what happened inside the car, or to think, oh my God, that's probably what happened inside the car.
Yeah.
You know?
Crazy.
Because that was, and
well,
that
that's
was
where
huge.
The line, that's where the line gets crossed a little bit, where they've got to, I mean, how are they going to know?
As possible, right?
Yeah. And that's why I think that, Michael, I think that your presence, you know, you have a lot to reveal about that, because that's always the question, because you can't. How do you capture the grimace on somebody's face when you weren't there?
We do know at length what he said, because all of those phone conversations were recorded. And if you go on the internet, or if you go on my Twitter page, at Fleeman111, I posted the entire transcript of O.J. Simpson talking to Tom Lang, the detective.
Oh, wow.
And you can really feel and you can really picture what's going on just by his words. And they took a lot of that verbatim.
Wow. That's crazy. So much time and such a long day. And I'm going to go ahead and use that as a little commercial break. You might be hungry during a car chase. And if that's the case, you know, you can go to Blue Apron for those of you who love to cook. And if you know how to cook, not only do you feel like you know your way around the kitchen, but cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout again.
This is just a word for our sponsors.
This is a word for our sponsors. Yeah. And where do you start? Blue Apron has you covered. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers all fresh ingredients you need to create a home-cooked meals. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less.
Oh,
and that's for everyone who's really busy
hungry
here in Los Angeles.
During a car chase,
right? During a car chase.
But we're thankful to Blue Apron for helping us to put this show together.
Of course. Yeah. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store. No more sad takeout. No matter your dietary preferences, which we all know we have very specific ones, especially out here. Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like a roast chicken supreme with mashed potatoes, gravy, and maple glazed carrots, spiced salmon with black rice, avocado, and blood orange salad, Lebanese arrays, and roasted spiced cauliflower. Or for those who like something a little heartier, we have a steak sandwich with caramelized onions, garlic aioli, and honey roasted parsnips, some fries, charred broccoli over creamy polenta and poached
eggs. Oh my God.
I swear, this is all here, and I'm told that I have to say all of it,
but
so you're
making
hearing
us salivate.
It all. It's true. You know why? Because I'm a sizzler of food, and that's what I do. But cook with ingredients that you've never used before, like watermelon radishes, farro, and purple potatoes, which are really delicious with some duck fat, by the way. And recipes are between 500 to 700 calories per portion, delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first two meals for free at blueapron.com/podcast. Now, remember the podcast so that you can get those two meals for free. And again, that's blueapron.com/podcast. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Awesome. Yeah.
Now I'm officially starving.
Yes. Yeah. And if Caitlin, if you're out there and you're watching, two meals for free.
Wow.
Sorry, it had to be said, you know. Blue Apron, though, is awesome. We appreciate you.
So it's June 17th, 1994. The NBA Finals are happening.
Yeah.
The New York Knicks versus the Houston Rockets. People are excited about this game, and all of a sudden it's shrunk down to a little box on the TV. Do you remember that at all?
I remember that they broke in to the NBA Finals, and that is unprecedented. And if you talk to people like Costas or Dan Patrick, who covered them at the time, and they remember that and how surreal that was, that something was happening in sports, arguably, because O.J. Simpson was a football player at the exact same time. Also, keep in mind, an estimated 100 million people watched that Bronco chase. That's almost as many people who watched the Super Bowl last Sunday. So it was also a ratings decision. This is what people really wanted to watch more than the New York Knicks.
And that says something about it.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably one of the most shocking moments for me. I was like, they turned off the finals for this? Yes. I had no idea.
I think there was a split screen through much of it.
Even that is too much. It's the finals of the NBA finals. That's, I was like, what?
Crazy. Yeah.
That's almost as many people that are going to watch our show here.
Oh, yeah.
But for the next week when they find out that Michael was on.
Yeah. But it certainly underscored like how what the resonance that whole chase had for everyone. I thought it was,
the gravitas. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it was a big deal.
Absolutely. I almost feel like as if the reaction of everyone as well, and I hate to use the comparison, reminded me of 9/11, the way everyone's eyes were on the screen. And I wonder if it was that quiet when it was happening.
It was actually the opposite. It was, and that's why the episode was so powerful. It was almost joyous. It was, people were cheering. They were putting up signs. It was, go Juice, go.
It was very strange. Bizarre. It was surreal.
Yeah, wasn't a somber occasion except for the guy in the Bronco.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, even meaning when it was cut and
the people were, you know, people would run down to the freeway on the 405 freeway. They would go into the streets of Brentwood, and they're cheering, and they're ordering pizzas, and it was like an entertainment event.
But it seemed, Michael, wouldn't you say that even back then, because as you said that, you reminded me that it didn't even seem divided across racial lines at that point. It seemed like everybody was celebrating.
I think it was a weekend. It was a party. And it was just something weird going on in Los Angeles. And remember, at this time, and still to a lesser degree, car chases were a big deal on television.
They didn't happen every day like they do today.
And local TV news would break in to a show for just a regular car chase. And now we have O.J. Simpson in this case. It sort of blurred the line between what's real and what's entertainment. Mm-hmm. People looked at it as like an entertaining, fun event.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that people were cheering him on and like even getting out of the road for him to continue going. And it made me wonder, if he had not run, was he that beloved that maybe everyone would have been on his side? Because, you know, by the time he hits a trial, there are deep divisions. People are thinking this guy's guilty.
I missed that. You said if he was that beloved.
Was he so beloved, had he not run, would he actually have been, would have everyone thought he was innocent?
Interesting.
Or would have that brought in doubt to other people.
Yeah.
I thought it was crazy to see this sign, run, OJ, run.
Yeah. I was just so shocked.
Well, remember, that was something, he was a running back for the Buffalo Bills and USC, you know, just down the freeway. And people thought it was almost like OJ reliving his great moments in football. The juxtaposition between this horrible, horrible double murder and this man who's going to go on trial for his life and these people waving signs and cheering, you know, was jarring.
Michael, did people really comprehend, though, what had happened at that time when they were watching the Bronco chase?
I think people thought,
were the photos already out there, the crime scene photos and everything?
No, the crime scene wasn't, I don't think people thought it. They just thought this was something weird going on. Let's run down to the freeway. Everybody's doing it. We can get on TV. We can be part of history, which they were.
Yes.
That's fascinating. And it was the Kardashians' first reality show.
Well, I mean, really? You know, and that's what everyone is now saying. And, they're really playing up
the
Kardashians.
Are.
Yeah.
Especially the kids.
Yes.
Who grew up to be Khloe and, you know, Kim. But, yeah, I think of the many things we can blame the O.J. Simpson case on is the kind of reality television phenomenon. It was the first big reality show.
And that's because that's what you said. That was the blending between news and reality, and it really was.
Yeah,
right. Because everyone watched this every day, correct?
Yeah,
it was something like that. Yeah, so
for almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we're starting to get into the characters more and more, and I want to talk about Robert Shapiro. Mm. In this episode, we see how really egotistical he is.
Yeah.
I mean, it started out with him saying, they're making me the unspoken villain. And he had to come out and do a press conference just to kind of clear his own thing that was going on, his own name. And then what I thought was interesting later on is he's driving. Everybody else is listening to the news. What is he listening to? Just music, just kind of driving along in his car. And then he gets home and his wife's like, oh, my gosh, they found OJ. And he's like, oh, he's still alive. Did he care at all about OJ and the case? I mean,
we knew Bob Shapiro before this. He was a very famous lawyer in Los Angeles, and for years after it. And to me, it's the one sort of sour note in the series. Yes, he was a slick L.A. criminal defense lawyer, but I don't think he was that vain.
Okay.
I think he was deeply concerned about Simpson. Okay. He was also deeply concerned about his reputation with the police department. He did deliver the Menendez boys. He did work out this deal for OJ to surrender without, you know, being hauled off by the police. And he has clients that he had to think about in the future, and he was really worried that he was going to mess up his relationship with the DA's office and the police department.
So you think the characterization was just a little bit...
I think it's one that is a little over the top, yeah.
Okay.
And I'll add, as an attorney, your reputation is the most important thing, and that reputation is the most important thing for your client. And so I think it was very important for him to preserve his reputation. And people may have seen that as egotistical, mm-hmm. but that was his reputation for his clients.
Good to know.
Yeah, right. Where it's coming from can be perceived a different way. And I have to say, because I did meet with Bob Shapiro, like I mentioned, last month. And I sat in his office. And while he seemed that he was a lawyer's lawyer. He's there to do the job of either suing somebody or keeping somebody from going to prison. But... I didn't get that much ego from him when I met him either, to be fair to him. And he's been really nice. He's sent emails and stuff. He's responded, and a lot of people don't do that. Yeah. So
the more the police trust you, the more other lawyers trust you, the more judges trust you, you're going to be a better advocate for your client.
Right.
I was surprised he had a line where he said, "Good for you, you're still in the game," when he was watching the car chase.
Yeah.
I had mentioned to you, I was wondering if that was because he thought it would help in their case. You said that it might have been his own.
Yeah, well, you know, I think as an attorney, you're just a natural fighter, you know,
right.
So you're ready for the fight. And so I think he was overjoyed that OJ was still alive so that fight could take place.
Okay.
What did you think?
With confident in his skills to get him off.
No, I think I thought that as well. And I thought, my head went directly to him thinking, okay, great, people are going to see that you're running and that you're not giving up and that you didn't kill yourself, so it has to mean that you're fighting for your innocence.
You're in there. Okay,
and then
interesting.
All of a sudden, I'm hearing from everyone else, no, he ran, he's not innocent.
But then you look at the DA who was in, and I was going to run for mayor.
Right.
You know, so it's like,
that was a throwaway because he...
That's Gil Garcetti.
Yeah.
Anyone who lives in L.A. knows Eric Garcetti. Yeah. The mayor is his son.
That was a good little...
Gil Garcetti was a rising political star at the time, and DA is always a stepping stone to mayor, attorney general, governor, and he was mentioned in those sentences all the time. And the O.J. case destroyed his political career, and I was... couple months ago at City Hall, and there was Gil Garcetti going through the metal detector, probably visiting his son. Nobody recognized him.
Wow.
It's got to be hard. How many people's careers do you think were ruined by this case?
I think it had, and you know, those of us who covered it, and it was like a hothouse. It was a very intense experience. And I think all of us were deeply affected one way or the other, whether we're journalists or the lawyers. And it did. It wrecked a lot of lives one way or the other. I don't think Marsha Clark was ever the same.
Right.
Chris Darden was never the same. No one can mention Lance Ito without laughing. Gil Garcetti was destroyed. It really wrecked. Aside from maybe Greta Van Susteren, who became very famous as a commentator, and Roger Cossack to a lesser degree, and Jeff Toobin, who wrote the book that this was made into, it did not bode well for a lot of people.
Hmm. My goodness.
I was just going to say, I could only imagine it actually tarnishing people's images and lives just because you're going through it every single day. And to, again, like I said, to think that it happened here in Los Angeles, I do feel as if we are a very close city, so anything that happens really does feel close to home.
Absolutely.
Even though if I was in any other city and something had happened, you're not attached. You know, like we know every, not borough because we're not in New York, but you know what I'm saying? All the big cities here, we're involved with everything that happens in Los Angeles. Yeah. So that's crazy for something that serious to happen. And again, in Brentwood and with someone who's kind of high on top.
Yeah.
And it's on TV every single day. So as a kid, you're like, oh my God, who is this guy? Like, what's happening? It becomes a part of your memories as a child.
Can I ask you about one more characterization? The characterization of Chris Darden. What's your take on that?
I think,
because they paint him out to be real lazy, kind of slothy, kind of...
No. I think they're setting him up as more of a martyr than perhaps he really was.
Okay.
He was deeply conflicted. People forget that Johnny Cochran worked in the DA's office. He was a supervisor in the DA's office. He was Lance Ito's supervisor. And people like Chris Darden...
Johnny Cochran was Lance Ito's supervisor.
Yes, in the DA's office before he became a private attorney. And people like Chris Darden looked up to Johnny Cochran. And I think Darden saw him as a mentor. And two black lawyers trying to make it mm-hmm. Up against an awful lot. And throughout the entire trial, Chris Darden was, you know, again, this very, it's almost like a Greek tragedy. He was very, very torn. And, but
he
at the same time,
apathetic.
Yeah. At the same time, look, he was a prosecutor. He was a lawyer. I don't know that it was as deep as they're trying to make it at this point. I feel like Chris's problems occurred later on as things got kind of crazy with the trial. I don't even know how much he was paying attention to any of this. I think a lot of this is from his book. But he was. He was one of those who was really scarred by this entire experience and very disillusioned. He saw Johnny Cochran, his hero, was very disillusioned by him, disillusioned by the justice system, and by himself and his role in all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we see him talking about, you know, don't publicize OJ. He's not a as good of a person as Jim Brown was. Jim Brown gave back to the community, and we should, you know, there's parks out there.
Not as good a football player. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so already we're kind of seeing his character unfold in the show, which is really cool to see. But let's talk about Johnny Cochran real quick. That interview, and Stephanie, I know you had something that you wanted to say about...
Just I loved hearing the beginning part where he says that this is a really complex situation and that this is someone who's not used to being chased. This is someone who's not used to being in the criminal system, you know, where some people growing up, you might have gone to juvie, whatever, you get the idea. And he's like, he's very fragile and confused. And I felt like you have to remember, as much as everyone might be thinking, oh, yeah, he did it, I'm so sympathetic during all of this to think, no, you don't know what he's going through, and he is confused, and that is why he's running. And at the end of the day, like he says, he is proven innocent, or he is innocent.
Yeah.
He gave him presumption. He is innocent until proven guilty. And at the end of the day, that is exactly where it is and where it starts.
And that's what I loved about that scene, was that Cochran really kind of underscored the presumption of innocence. You know, it doesn't matter what you do, if you did run. But in this country, we have a presumption of innocence, and I think with that run, OJ started with definitely the presumption of guilt.
And he did it with strength, and it made sense. Yeah. When you heard it, it was like, yeah, he's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Were you going to say something?
Cochran recognized a lot of things that people didn't. This was 2 years after the LA riots.
Right.
And it's a slight overstatement, but imagine if today, a year or two after Ferguson, somebody was arrested in Ferguson, an African American, a hero. What would the climate be for that person? Okay, Los Angeles burned 2 years before this trial, and Johnny Cochran was the only one who saw the racial aspect, the cultural aspect, the divide in this city. And his detractors will say, yes, he exploited that, and that he used it, the race card, but he knew. He knew what was percolating under the surface long before anybody else did. I don't know that Marsha Clark ever fully appreciated that. He knew what was tearing this city apart and how it would relate to a very complicated figure like O.J. Simpson, who had a very complicated relationship with the white community, with the black community. He was always in kind of this netherworld. Not exactly black, not exactly white, not exactly respected and embraced the black community, not really respected and embraced the white community. Mm-hmm. And Johnny, more than anybody, understood these complexities, these nuances in the case. And I think that's what he was able to bring to bear during the trial.
So what I really appreciate about what you're saying there is you're lending appreciation toward the reality of that, not just the exploitation of that, but that's the way it was.
Johnny Cochran made his living suing the Los Angeles Police Department for police misconduct.
It was happening, yeah.
Never went to trial, because what he would do is he would say, okay, we're going to trial. Please give us the personnel records of the cops involved in this case. You can only imagine what was in those records.
What?
No. Here's $3 million.
Wow.
Go away.
Wow.
He knew the LAPD better than the LAPD knew itself.
And I like that you mentioned that, because we see a side conversation with Chris Drodden, and they're talking about how, you know, OJ never gave back. And the second he made his money, he went to the other side and didn't look that way. And I could see someone coming from that place. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I was amazed by white people when I was younger. Perfect example. No, seriously, where like a pantry, for instance. I never knew what that was. So you can only imagine growing up and then hanging out with these people and seeing it and then being accepted more so. You would want to be there. And then they make a comment where it's where you see how where they're at, where he goes, well, he's black now because they're chasing after him.
And, you know what? Yes. O.J. Simpson grew up in the projects of San Francisco, very poor. Father, I believe, died of AIDS. He knew crime. Right. He knew what it meant to be in those situations. People forgot that. And I think a lot of what you saw during the Bronco chase was O.J., who had spent his life running away from those projects, literally running away from Arenthal James and creating this brand known as O.J. Simpson, was suddenly thrown back into the projects. He was little Arenthal again, and he was facing his ultimate demons, the thing that he tried to hide and tried to run away from his entire life. And I think that's a lot of what was going on inside that Bronco.
That is why I can almost guarantee you why he kept saying, I'm sorry. He kept saying, I'm sorry, and it was pissing me off because he was saying, I'm sorry, when he's like, I would never hurt you guys. He's still in that mentality, meaning he has already developed this ridiculous complex of the juice and of what where he was accepted, and I'm sorry for being an inconvenience, I'm sorry about this, I'm sorry about that. What about, you know, don't say you're sorry, kind of get yourself into the situation. And what's crazy about this whole chase, at this point, I mean, he mentions Nicole a couple of times, but the murders are now forgotten.
Oh, yeah. It became about O.J.
It's all about O.J.
That just goes to underscore the fact that there was some reality to the accusations of what had happened. You know, it's like if all this was not him who had done it, one would think that he would be right there helping them out, trying to find out who did it, and that there would be no running. There wouldn't be anything like that. I don't believe that he, in fact, in the first episode, he said, I'm not black. I'm O.J. Right. So
again, the complex, though.
Yeah.
Which goes to show you, though, he might have been a little bit. I mean, I think he was a little unstable, and I think that that has everything to do with everything that led up to the night that something may or may have not happened.
Well, I thought the portrayal of him actually kind of humanized him, because I felt like, okay, now I either said to myself, he either is innocent and wants to kill himself, or he did it, but he's very remorseful.
Right.
That's how I felt. Mm-hmm.
Was he as emotionally unstable as they portrayed him to be?
Well, certainly during that,
sure.
He hit the gun to his head,
I think what was so jarring to people was that he had this very kind of amiable, happy-go-lucky, charming, big smile demeanor. He was in those Naked Gun movies. He did Hertz commercials. He was, you know, a sideline broadcaster for football. And then to see him, and we'll get to it next week, I'm sure, when he got into court, and he was still very disheveled, still, really kind of out to lunch, not wearing a tie because they were afraid he was going to hang himself. And to see this man like that was a real shock to people at the time, because that was not what we thought O.J. Simpson was.
Right, and when you... When you heard him say things like in the letter that he wrote, you know, please remember me for who I was, not this disheveled man.
Yeah.
You know, I'm paraphrasing here. To me, do you read guilt in the language that's used in the letter?
Hard to say. I think what I read is O.J. Simpson living this sort of duality his whole life, and that O.J. was, and he would talk about O.J. in the second person, not me, but O.J. And that was kind of this thing he created, the sports star, the pitch man, the actor, you know, the comic persona. And what he was seeing and experiencing was just all these walls crumbling, and it was a real breakdown. Now, whether guilt was in there somewhere, you know, I don't know. I mean, that was I don't think we can speculate on that. But clearly, a lot was going on in his head that transcended even those murders.
Wow.
I agree with
you. I want to talk about the LAPD again. That scene where they pull them over. It's about 65 miles away from Encino, Irvine Center Drive, my hood, Orange County. And they come up to his car, and they don't shoot. They know that there's a gun in the vehicle. What did you guys think about that scene?
They shouldn't shoot.
I thought it was crazy. Just
they shouldn't shoot. But I'm saying, I wish that could be said for every situation.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what flew me. It was just how resonant it is with today.
Exactly.
And I was like, oh my God, there's a black guy, and he's fleeing, and they didn't shoot.
And they didn't shoot.
Yes, yeah. But I think it underscores, I guess, the role of celebrity and money as well in these cases. Because that to me was very just jarring, especially given the current climate. So I just noticed that.
Yeah, they were very cognizant of the celebrity, and it certainly did stop. But yeah. I mean, you're only supposed to shoot if your life's in danger or somebody else's life is in danger, and so they shouldn't shoot in that situation.
The freeway was clear.
Even the fact that they questioned it was interesting. Although a case could be made that the car would be a danger to somebody else.
Yeah, but they had some really good throwaway lines. Like, this is OJ. Yeah. No one shoot.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah. I'm not shooting at OJ
without permission.
The most I'll give them that it was broad daylight and they could see better, but that's about it. But
when they turned off the lights, when the SWAT team turned off the lights and Johnny Cochran
said... Right, that's a different
exception,
but we're specifically talking about...
Okay, yes.
On the freeway.
Yeah.
Johnny also mentions his first case with Leonard, I didn't get the last name, where he was shot and killed driving his wife. Mm.
Detweiler, to
the hospital. Yeah. So it's just funny that those two situations, you know, one is brought up and the other one is just being lived.
It's such a race issue, but it's also a class issue, too. And so, yeah, I thought that was interesting to see.
I think it has to do with education, too. And it's funny how history continues to repeat itself, even though we attempt to make these lessons and learn them, but they're not being heard. And so I think a lot of it has to do with people being scared. And had it been any situation in Ferguson or somewhere else, they probably wouldn't have been so quick to do it, or they would have.
And it kind of made me wonder, how is Johnny Cochran, if he does at all, going to change throughout the series? Because he's in that climate where he feels that, you know, black people are getting fairly treated. And so he's probably thinking in his mind, to me, that OJ probably is innocent here. And let's just take a look at what's happening. So I wonder if he ever gets to a point where he's just like, well, I guess my thoughts and feelings were justified, but maybe I have the wrong case. I don't know. I'm wondering if he gets a turn of, you know.
That remains to be seen. Huh? What really impressed me, and it's just kind of an aside, but was Johnny Cochran's communication ability, his ability to, weave a vision for people that would, you know, grab their hearts and minds. There's a few people like Jerry Spence is a really good storyteller like that from a lawyering perspective. But Johnny's, he was quite brilliant.
Yeah, and this episode is very ideological. So I'm wondering how reality starts to hit him when he gets involved with the case, what he'll start to look like.
I feel like he's the only one that's neutral right now.
Yeah, he's got the, because he can be, you know.
Right.
So.
Robert Kardashian. Mm. We see him come into the media for the first time. People are like, Dardashian? They're pronouncing his name wrong. We see his emotional side, his religious side. What do you guys think about that?
I thought the religious side was quite lovely.
It was interesting.
It was interesting. And then the last part of that prayer was he knows not what he is doing.
Mm, yeah.
And that only set into me because, I mean, faith is always brought into circumstances like this when you kind of need it when you're desperate. And I think part of that's very true. Sometimes people don't know what they're doing, and that's why they need the help. But it was really nice to see. I didn't know how emotionally Robert Kardashian was involved, rather than just the judicial side.
Right.
So that was crazy because he seemed as much as a wreck as OJ was.
And Michael, would you say that he was the tie between the whole situation and the family?
Yes. And Bob Kardashian was one of his oldest friends. Although, interestingly, they had drifted apart before all this and had only seen each other a few times in the year leading up to this. But he was one of his old friends, one of his golfing buddies. I mean, they all hung out there at the country club in Brentwood. And Kardashian was the first to kind of come to his side, to come to his aid. He was a gentleman. I interviewed him after the trial, and I did a long story for Los Angeles Magazine on Robert Kardashian after the trial. And he was a very ethical person. He was a very moral person, very religious person. He put loyalty and friendship above everything. He stood for many of the values that you don't associate with the name Kardashian right now. And I always kind of wonder
what
he, if he had been alive today, would think of what became of the Kardashian name. But that's beside the point. But he was sort of the go-between. He was a lawyer. Technically, he reactivated his license so he could have privilege and not have to, you know, testify. And he did. He served as sort of the go-between, not just between the family and OJ, but the family and the lawyers and OJ and the lawyers. And he was always there. And, I mean, I don't want to ruin it for you, but I want you to look at video. Go on YouTube and look at the video of the reading of the verdict. And in the frame is OJ, and right behind him is Bob Kardashian. And I want you to look at the expression on Robert Kardashian's face when OJ Simpson is found not guilty. And it will tell you a lot about what kind of man he is.
Oh, come on, ruin it for us.
He is aghast. I think he thought from day one OJ was guilty, but that loyalty and friendship and justice and process trumped everything, and that he deserved his day in court. He didn't deserve to shoot and kill himself and or be killed by the cops. He deserved his day in court, and I think Kardashian felt very strongly about that. That's not to say he thought he was innocent. I think he thought he was guilty.
What do you think of David Schwimmer's portrayal?
I think it's pretty good. I think it got better. It was hard. What was it, Ross? I couldn't get that out of my head last week. I don't think we've ever seen Schwimmer in a dramatic role.
I thought he was really good.
Yeah. And again, go on YouTube. There are videos of that press conference where he's reading the suicide note. He really captured that.
Question for you. The episode opens and it's got him praying, right? That was when he was praying.
Yes.
Was he praying? This is to everybody. Was he praying for OJ, for what OJ was going to do, or for what OJ had done?
I think he was praying for just the situation.
Yes.
Robert Kardashian knew Nicole Simpson. Mm-hmm. Okay, Chris, then Jenner, now Chris Kardashian, who was his ex-wife at the time, but Chris Kardashian, was one of the closest friends to Nicole Simpson. And so they were a very tight-knit family. So, I mean, he's grieving, too, over the loss of Nicole. And he's grieving over what could be happening. I mean, and this is what is so wonderful about this series. It really captures the sort of epic Shakespearean scope of this story. And I think he's just overwhelmed by the sense of tragedy and what could happen and all the lives that have been lost will be lost. That's what he's praying about.
Yeah, I think it spoke to OJ's kind of suicide because he really felt that OJ was dead. He tells the family it looks like he's gone, you know. So I think when he's praying, he's really praying because he also thinks OJ has killed himself.
And OJ, I think, felt the same way. You could see he was torn apart, like you said, that he had this, you know, this battle within himself. And you know, it just makes you wonder why crime of passion was never the defense rather than the other way around.
Well, I mean, not guilty is always better than I did. Well,
obviously.
I brought up crime of passion last week, and I really like that you mentioned him. Well, first, that you said that they hadn't spoken for about a year or so, right?
Just a couple of times.
Right. Yeah. And I almost feel like I kind of perceived that considering the fact that Bobby was no longer... Bobby, like I know him. Sorry, that Robert Kardashian was no longer with Chris. And I could tell that's the reason why I like this character, and I know that he was just Ross, which I kept trying to preach to everyone. Remember, like, give them the chance to be a different character, you know, because that's all an actor wants, is to play more than one person their whole life.
A typecast.
Right, a typecast. But I totally think it was the loyalty, and last week I had also mentioned that it's so hard to know someone and the potential that they have to do something, but you refuse to say that because, you know, the same way a mother would love their child no matter what. If you're a loyal person and, you know, I hate to use this religion, if you're Catholic and kind of have that guilt, and I am the same way, you kind of stick to that. And I think that does implement everything that you do in your decisions because of kind of your belief.
And so, one thing we did miss, he read that suicide note.
Yeah.
I don't know how calculated that was. It may have been more calculated than we saw. Because, you know, the DA comes out and says he went on the chase, right?
And calculated on the defense
side.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know if you have any thoughts
on that. They Bob Shapiro and Robert Kardashian did not want OJ to kill himself. Yeah. And they were doing everything they could to try to keep him from killing himself. And I think
the police were too.
Yeah. And I think they thought that reading this note would somehow reach him, or he'd hear it on the radio, or they were just trying to get to him. They were trying to save him. And if you go on the internet, the whole text of that note, including "peace and love, OJ" with a smiley face, which is how he signed everything, is in that note. But the note is heartbreaking. And I think they thought that if they read that, that would somehow convince OJ to.
If there was some noblesse in the situation, though, everybody was doing their job in that case. The friends, the police were doing their job, though, but nobody was.
See, I wasn't sure they were, if they were ready to kind of priming the jury pool. Because the worst thing to have is a DA come out and talk about, look for OJ, find him, bring him to justice, because he is running. It's just the worst thing to ever have. So my defense strategy would be, well, we have this really sympathetic note. Let's get out in front of the press and read this note and make sure it's out there and make sure it's read by a good friend of OJ. So it's like really resonates.
But a suicide note, why is somebody going to commit suicide who didn't commit the murder?
No, I think that makes it look like you maybe didn't commit the murder because you're so distraught, and then you're now accused. Maybe now you're going to actually kill yourself.
Your whole world is falling apart.
That helps the run. When people think you're running versus people thinking you're running to go maybe kill yourself away from your family.
Right. We have to remember that this is all happening over a course of 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And there wasn't a lot of calculation. People were just, they've got a guy out in a Bronco with a gun at his head. What can we do? We got this note. Why don't we read the note? I don't think there was a lot of calculation, a lot of cynicism later on. At this point, I think they were just trying to save his life.
Michael, you've covered so much because you had this depth and this huge background in press and media. With the police, you said that there was when they went in and they were looking at things they had done in the past in terms of planting evidence, that type of stuff. How prevalent was that really at that time? That
it,
type of
it was something that Johnny Cochran knew better than anybody, and that was this very antagonistic relationship between people, say, in South Central Los Angeles and the police department, and long-time suspicions that they would be, doing all kinds of shenanigans. Maybe not to frame somebody, but to make somebody guilty look a little more guilty. This was something that people knew about, and Johnny Cochran knew would respond to at some point. Because
it was happening. But I would assume that you have like an in-depth. You've been studying this stuff for so long. Has it happened and been documented a lot with the LAPD?
No, because it's sly. It's secret. And I think it's not so much the planting of, it's just the fact that you cannot trust the LAPD to investigate anything involving African Americans. It's just, you can't.
Would you say that still to this day, or is that?
I think that the city has gone great strides in the last 20 years, and it's not like it was 2 years after the riots, 2 years after Rodney King was beat up. You were talking about why were they so, gentle with O.J. Simpson. Right. That video of Rodney King being beat up, that is fresh in every cop's mind. They don't want to be the next, cops on videotape shooting or beating somebody up. So they were being very, very careful. But at that time, it was the relationship between the community and the police was extremely bad, extremely bad. And, that's what Johnny Cochran knew, and that's what he exploited later on.
And, you've seen some of the same issues today. I mean, you see it in Making of a Murderer where there's those implications of whether they planted stuff. I forget what the case was we just saw a couple of weeks ago where the police officer, would he drop like a knife?
Like a taser or something next to the guy.
So these things are happening. They've happened before, whether it's chain of custody issues or things that they try to make better. I think a lot of times the police department is thinking, we're making that guilty person look more guilty. We're wrapping this case up.
That's utterly ridiculous. Yeah, that's
but the fact that these things are happening at all is very problematic.
Wrong.
Yeah.
Very wrong. Yeah.
All right. I think that is the episode. Want to do some news and gossip? Just two little tidbits.
Yeah. I want to say that it was Leslie T who sent us the video of Marsha Clark.
Yes.
On The View. And we see her, and it was really nice to see that I was actually right. It was very sexist at that time, and when she didn't have that trial to herself.
Oh.
And so, sorry, because she had mentioned, and it was like really nice to hear that.
Yeah.
It's crazy how she said that it's okay to watch, but at the same time, it's a little stressful because of how. Because it really was, like, really you're living it.
I mean, you could imagine what it must look like, feel like, rather,
right.
to see yourself, you know.
Yeah.
And I think what makes it even more difficult is how realistic it is. And you can't, the people who are involved can't say, oh, they totally fictionalized. No, right. They're really touching nerves with this series, and I think that's a credit to the producers.
Just a quick question, Michael, on that front, with Marsha Clark, because it seems, do you think, who made more mistakes, the prosecution or the police leading up to the prosecution? Because she seemed to want to take him down for the crime.
Yeah, and you're going to see, and Tubin covers this very, very well in the book that's based on, it was Marsha Clark's hubris and arrogance that really, really, I mean, in Tubin's mind, undermined this case. But the cops screwed it up from day one. They had O.J. Simpson in an interrogation room without a lawyer, and they blew it, okay? Mm-hmm. They didn't seal the deal. And then it just went downhill from then. When you see the later episodes, I'm sure they're going to get into it, and Marsha Clark not listening to people, not taking advice from people, picking a majority African-American jury against the advice of
She took it for granted. She
people.
Thought it was too easy.
She
thought it was
well,
a
Well, she thought, you'll see, she used what she thought was her experience to the best of her ability prosecuting a lot of domestic violence cases. And it's something they hint at in this episode. She saw this as a domestic violence case, and that's how she was going to prosecute it. She had very good luck with black women on juries, getting convictions for domestic violence, and she completely misread it.
I can't wait to see more. Yeah. Also, the premiere episode, last week's episode, drew in 12 million viewers.
Wow.
So huge
people
opening
are
for FX.
Locked in, yeah.
Also, neighbors are reporting that there's an increase in foot traffic on Bundy Drive. People are trying to walk over. Although I heard that the address was changed and there's now tall trees kind of covering the condo, but still there's a lot of people trying to
check it out. I mean, I was on my way to work. Every time I'm on my way to work, I was like, should I drive? Should I drive over there? Just because I was so tempted, you know?
And I guess we'll see in the upcoming episodes if we get any more Kardashian drama. They kind of milked it a little bit with the Kardashians
in this
episode.
Yeah, are they doing that? I wonder, you're wondering if they're doing that just for the extra viewership or is that the...
It does remind you that there was a time that no one knew that name, right?
Mm-hmm.
That people were saying, what was your name again?
Right? I'll give them that they might have been really excited to see their dad on TV, but that's it.
Too much. Too many.
Everything else was a lot.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you so much for joining
us.
It was so
awesome.
Insightful.
You're
Where
awesome.
Can people find you and follow you?
I'm on Twitter at Fleeman111, or you can go to my website, truecrimepage.com.
Awesome. And you can find me on Twitter at PegaRad.
And Shaka Smith at Shaka Strong.
And me on Twitter at Stephanie Georgie and on Instagram at TheStephanieGeorgie.
And me at Chris Howard Live on Twitter and LegendaryLivingDaily.com and LegendaryLivingTV.com on YouTube.
Thanks so much for watching. We'll see you next week.
Awesome.
Bye.
Ciao, guys.
From executive producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire AfterBuzz TV staff, we would like to thank you for listening to the AfterBuzz TV network. To watch or listen to other after shows and post comments or questions, be sure to visit AfterBuzzTV.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of AfterBuzz TV.
Buzz see you later.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of AfterBuzz TV or its owners or principals.